LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
It sounds a little like are you moving something around that's a little noisy on the...
My feet.
Oh, okay.
I got those rubber soles, which you mock at every opportunity. All right, I took them off. You happy now, Mr. Audio Sensitivity?
And with that, thank you so much for joining us.
That's a good cold open.
Timothy Donner, host of Liberty Nation Radio. Welcome, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza. Go ahead. Do you have something to add?
People love unprepared opening.
Well,
you know, it makes us sound like very Trumpian, you know, to just throw out whatever comes to mind and then leave it in publicly.
I think that's, I don't know if that's going to work quite as well for me that it does for him. But in any case, let's press on.
Well, I doubt you're going to be running for president anytime soon anyway. You are past the age of eligibility. Let's just put it that way.
I invite others to write me in, Tim. It's not an honor that I've, you know, that I've cultivated. But if that's what people choose, then how can I tell them not to? I certainly would, by the way.
What a man. What a saga.
I would do it just for the no speeding tickets. To me, it's worth it for that alone.
That's not a hard call.
All right. There were at least three new federal court election cases filed this week. We're recording at 12:21 in the PM on the 3rd of December. And I don't really think we're going to talk a whole lot about any of them because none of them, I believe, have a solid chance of flipping the election or, you know, kind of moving the needle before January the 20th. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I mean, if the thing was unsettled based on the volume of cases being brought by the Trump legal team, then I think Trump people could feel pretty optimistic. But if they look at it in terms of results, they've got two meager wins out of, what, dozens of lawsuits that's been filed. So, I mean, you have to just look. At this point, it's the reality on the ground even more than the merits of the cases. Because, you know, Scott, I mean, four separate states held hearings this week in one of their legislative bodies, House or Senate, in four individual states. And there was, you know, massive amounts of testimony that was presented, but nobody was covering it. Because they didn't consider, you know, they've called the election, and so they bought into their own designation of Joe Biden as president-elect, and they're failing to. And you know what? No matter whether you think these legal actions are justified or not, or wise or not, the fact that they're happening in a presidential election initiated by the sitting president. And who's bringing forward, you know, a lot of evidence, whether it's going to be accepted or result in anything ultimately is a separate question. But just failing to cover it is really head shaking. Like, look, we've moved on. You can file suits. And, you know, if these were civil suits after Biden had already won the Electoral College or next year, maybe. But this is a sitting president whose complaints are being heard across 4, 5, 6 battleground states, and yet it's as if it's not even happening.
You wrote an article for LibertyNation.com this week on sort of a survey of various election challenges. Is that fair to say?
True.
What I said,
the essence of what I said was that you don't have to be an expert in election law. You don't have to understand affidavits. You don't have to understand any of that to see that this election, the outcome was inexplicable. What I said was that all you have to do is look at the publicly available data and the voting patterns that constitute actual objective data. Just look at the, what I'm saying is if you just look at the objective data, forget the affidavits, forget the legal challenges, you know, forget the specifics of election law, forget the hundreds of cases that are in affidavit of breaking laws, of fraud, forget all of that. Just look at the trends, like what what happened, and of course, Exhibit A, Scott, is what happened with the overnight vote dumps in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and elsewhere. Vote dumps that turned a massive Trump lead.
So let me
in every state, it turned it. But just to finish up, the point is that it turned massive Trump leads into deficits in the space of 3-4 hours with massive vote dumps with no observers.
I have heard the stories about the massive vote dumps. And what I'm interested in hearing going forward is a sort of forensic examination of those vote additions that don't include just, and I don't mean to say just, but that don't include a lot of internet talk of, you know, I was watching and I went to bed and that kind of thing. I want to see this was the number reported and recorded by the county, you know, at this time and at this time, so that we're working off of, we're not working off of innuendo and
it's true, but there's already a good deal that we know for a fact. These vote dumps, one of them was like 700,000 votes that dumped all at once, and 99.4% of them went for Biden. 99.4%. You had 8 counties or cities, in most cases, in Michigan, that showed 100% or greater voter turnout. In one place, 700+% voter turnout, registered voters versus recorded votes. And in another one, you had over a 400% turnout. These things, see, are statistical impossibilities.
I have seen those numbers too, but I haven't seen them proven. Do you know what I mean by that?
That's hard data. That's publicly available data. That's the point that I'm making, is that you don't have to be a forensics expert to understand at the surface level that the whole thing doesn't add up. How about the black vote, Scott? In Milwaukee, for example, 84% compared to 51% in Cleveland, a comparable city, 90% turnout in Wisconsin. It's unheard of. That's never happened before. All these kind of publicly available, undisputed data, facts, you know, are all you need for, you know, to be convinced that the election is not on the up and up. Now, whether he wins in court or not, and likely not, doesn't change the immutability of these objective facts, and doesn't change the fact, Scott, that 80% plus of Trump voters, they don't believe the outcome that's been reported.
Tim, there's one place that the American people can look for shelter from the storm. And as usual, we turn to our cultural leaders, I think, at Hollywood for
leadership.
The best solution here.
Thank you, Scott.
Go ahead. You're going to thank me in a second after you hear this.
Members of the Electoral College, this message is for you. As you know, our founding fathers built the Electoral College to safeguard the American people from the dangers of a demagogue and to ensure that the presidency only goes to someone who is to an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications.
An eminent degree. Someone who is highly qualified for the job. The Electoral College was created specifically to prevent an unfit candidate from becoming president.
There are 538 members of the Electoral College. You
and just 36 other conscientious electors can make a difference.
By voting your conscience.
And thereby shaping the future of our nation.
As you know, the Constitution gives electors the right to vote for any eligible person.
Any eligible person, no matter which party they belong to.
But it should certainly be someone you consider especially competent.
Especially competent to serve as President of the United States of America.
By voting your conscience, you and other brave electors can give the House of Representatives the option to select a qualified candidate for the presidency.
I stand with you.
I stand with you.
I stand with you.
I stand with you in support and solidarity with conservatives, independents, and liberals.
And all citizens of the United States.
The American people trust that your voice speaks for us all.
And that you will make yourself heard through the constitutional responsibility granted to you by Alexander Hamilton himself.
It's very moving.
And all citizens of the United States.
I'm verklempt, Scott. I'm verklempt. I'm in tears over here.
All right, you get the point.
is that enough?
So
enough. I can't take any more.
Is there a person with more gravitas than Martin Sheen when he speaks as the former television president and instructs few. Us?
Very few.
Now, of course, that was released in the last election cycle,
right?
And those people didn't like the fact that Donald Trump won the presidency and won the Electoral College and won the race he was running in. And they encouraged the people, in spite of the fact that Donald Trump won fair and square the contest. Okay.
They'll never believe it was
fair and square. They wanted electors to just go against the will of the Constitution and the people because they didn't like the result. And, you know, the idea that it's somehow not okay for Donald Trump or Donald Trump partisans to challenge the results of this election in the courts, but it's okay for Democrats to ask electors to be what are called faithless electors, to violate their oath and not vote for the person who won their state, but just go against it. You know, Tim, I just think it's
you know what it is? I'll tell you what, that thing that we just played, that is the ultimate act of elitism. Think about it. 130 million, give or take, people have cast their ballots for president in 50 different states and plus territories, etc. And what they're saying is, you're not smart enough, wise enough, informed enough to make the decision. So why don't we let 538 people that we pick make the decision for you? That is, I can't imagine a more elite narrative than that.
I just think it's anybody who does their bidding is a hero, even if they violate their own oath. If you work for the president and you steal documents off his desk and throw them away, if they don't like the president, you're a hero. You're a traitor, of course, if it's somebody they like. And if you don't, if you're an elector and you vote for who you're supposed to vote for, and you don't vote for who you're supposed to, well, you're a hero if that it comports with their rulings and their preferences, rather. And if you don't, then you're an animal.
We're going to see what happens with what's broadly been called the Trump Accountability Project, which is basically, it's going to be a roving gang of Trump haters who will be given, it'll basically be open season.
It's the most disgusting thing. So let me just tell people for
what
it is.
And that's not going to be talked down.
This
that
is an
will
effort.
Not be discouraged by mainstream
this
Democrats.
This is an effort to punish anybody who was in the pro-Trump or non-anti-Trump camp. So if you're either a never-Trumper or Democrat, or you're part of this group that they can now shun or worse. We need to be on guard against it. It is vile and disgusting. The idea that people who have a different policy preference for some others are, you know, should be basically denied the right to earn a crust, while Martin Sheen can tell people to go out and violate their oath for the Electoral College, but that's a heroic act.
Scott, come on. Did he not demonstrate his bottomless cup of wisdom when he was on TV for all those years in the West Wing, which is a totally, by the way, totally unbiased, very balanced.
Tim, it was so
depiction
brave.
Of the presidency.
It was so brave. They spoke truth to power for all those years.
Yes.
And
amen, brother.
We encourage. Yeah, it's actually funny when you go back and watch it, because all it is it's a, what they do is they tear from the headlines a scandal. This is the Sorkin method, all right. By the way, and if you go through a couple episodes, it'll be easy to, if you haven't, you know, not that I'm Albert Einstein for figuring it out, but you take a scandal out of the pages of the newspaper, and then anything that a Democrat did, you make it less odious, okay, or less problematic, and anything that a Republican did, you make it worse.
It's so, a simple formula. Simple right. formula. You know, it's at least the algorithm is so.
Right.
Cemented into place that, you know, you don't right. have to think about how
yeah.
to so, project so here's, an
so,
angle.
So here's how this
story.
Manifests itself, for instance, in the show. Instead of a president lying to a court about sexually, one second.
You always get thrown off.
Instead of a president,
I'm not going to go beyond the surface.
Instead of a president,
just an observation,
sexually harassing a young intern, which is what we know because of the power dynamics, what we know from feminism, that teaches us that Monica Lewinsky could not consent to a sexual relationship with Bill Clinton because of the power dynamic. But they don't portray that in the West Wing, because that would be awkward and, you know, who knows what would happen in terms of the judgment of the viewer, Tim. So what they do is they make the president's wife, the fictional wife of the president, cover up a disease that he has. He's got Parkinson's, and that's what he lies about, his own frailty, medically speaking, so that he can put that
right.
aside and
right.
serve the country,
right.
even though it may be to his deficit, right?
Right, sort of, right, right. He lies, right. but he lies in the public
right.
interest.
Yeah.
Right, put him in the FDR mold that FDR didn't want anybody to see that
and
he had polio.
And the Republicans and the Republicans on the show don't want gun control, you know, because so people could defend themselves or for liberty. They want it so that, you know, the lobbyists can sell
more guns.
Well,
you know what? I mean, look, in the case I brought up FDR, because, you know, there was a big debate years ago about whether he should be depicted at the FDR memorial sitting
right.
in a wheelchair. And the people that said he should ultimately won the argument. But when he was in office, I mean, that was a true I don't know if you'd call it a heroic act, but in the better interests of the country, some would say it was just his own pride or ego. I can't psychoanalyze it beyond the surface. But in that case, that was a real sort of act of or attempted act of nobility. So it's almost like the stolen valor of FDR was to be projected onto Martin Sheen. And these people, these Hollywood actors, Scott, they remain unconvinced that the American people place no stock in what they say, unless what they're saying is already the popular sentiment on the left, which means they're just jumping on the bandwagon. But they remain unconvinced. They still think because they can read a script and deliver lines
Tim,
in front
do not
of a camera.
Speak. Of Dr. Sheen that way, please.
Dr. Sheen, that's great.
It's almost impossible that he hasn't been awarded some honorary doctorate at some place, right? Don't you think so?
By the way, what's on
Google,
the doctor?
Google, play along at home and Google Dr.
Before
Martin Sheen and see where the whatever school of public policy gave
him
a doctorate.
Before I forget, we have to update the Dr. Jill watch. Is she, will she get a position in the cabinet, but what position is Jill? Oh my goodness.
Despite Tim, what?
You better cut that because I forgot to say doctor and the censors will be out on that one.
Tim,
Dr. Jill Biden, what position will she have in the administration?
Despite what one of our more keen political analysts, Whoopi Goldberg, has to say, I don't think that she's in the running for Surgeon General. because of course her doctorate is in education.
That's such a great soundbite.
Yeah, I heard somebody say something about Secretary of Education before, but I think that was more of a MSNBC wishful thinker than kind of a serious
sure. She's commentator. What? She's a grammar school teacher. So Secretary of Education, sure. That and makes
by the
sense.
Way, yeah, good for her. Like by all accounts, she, you know, nobody let her be a teacher. I'm sure she's doing great things in the classroom. And if she wanted to really help. You know, the best thing that Jill Biden could probably do is go into like the worst district school and be an elementary school teacher there just because of what her presence would do to the place for the kids, you know?
Yeah, look, I mean, look, by all accounts, she seems like a decent person and she'll pick what her issue is going to be. But I would suggest that it does not help her to take a position that is politically explosive.
I can't imagine she wants to get at this stage in her life. Why would she want to be? She can go she could dress up in fancy dresses and, you know,
I wouldn't think so. But, you know, some first ladies, and I'm not comparing her to Hillary Clinton, but, you know, Hillary Clinton wasn't going to be satisfied as first lady to just, have teas and.
Well, you know, the old joke is
she just wasn't going to do that.
The old joke is that Bill and Hillary are driving through Arkansas. In a car, and they stop for gas, and Bill chats with the guy, and he says to Hillary, "Aren't you glad you married?" Or excuse me, Hillary chats with the guy, and Bill Clinton says, "Yeah, well, aren't you glad you married me? If you married him, you'd be married to a gas station attendant." She says, "No, I wouldn't. I'd be married to President of the United States." Because in other words, she's the one who was as much of an engine behind that. Right. I don't get that.
Nowhere without her.
I don't know a great deal about Dr. Biden like I do about Hillary Clinton, but every sense I have from her is that she's not engineered this run to satisfy her own thirst for exercising power over others.
Do you think that in the dark shadow for her of the 2016 election, her dark night of the soul after she got embarrassed, do you think that she said to herself, so I'm the one that's supposed to be responsible for him, for his Bill's success. So let's see. He ran twice and won twice. I ran twice and lost twice, including the most ignominious defeat perhaps in American political history. Do you think that softens her view of her own importance or herself to any degree?
No, not if she's the malignant narcissist that I know in my bones her to be, Tim.
Ooh, I like that. malignant narcissist.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I have no antenna that picks that up from Dr. Jill. It's fun to make fun of her title, but I would sooner put her in charge of all laws in the country than any member of the Clinton family. It would not be a close call. I just don't get.
All right. How about
she craves ruling over others and commanding them? And go ahead.
Let me give you another choice.
Go ahead.
Who would you rather have ruling over you, Hillary? Right. Or Kamala? Hillary or Kamala?
I think that Hillary Clinton is dedicated and motivated to the destruction of all I hold dear, and Kamala could be convinced to that regard if it would accrue to her own power. But like to her last breath, Hillary would be trying to wrestle the guns or free speech out of my claws.
Cold,
you know what I mean?
Hands, yeah.
But Kamala Harris could be convinced that, you know, that's okay. Just let them do, you know, whatever. I mean, she flip-flops all
over. In other words,
her.
If it's to her benefit.
Yeah. If it gets her into the seat of power.
Right. So is it opportunism versus pure evil? Is that
the Kamala Harris is happy to lock up marijuana users or set them free, depending on what
that's true.
Demands of her being in power.
You're right. She's actually proven that, hasn't she?
And Hillary Clinton is all about the state in every regard, no matter what. It's more government all the time.
Boy, you're making me feel so much better about our prospective vice president.
It's way better. Also, divided the
deep sigh of relief.
How divided the Congress is. It's good. It's going to be, you know, mostly the hits, Tim, are going to come, I think, in the regulatory world and in the executive agency world. That's where.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that, I think.
I think you're right. I agree with you
in a future podcast, kind of mapping out where the threats to liberty. I'm sort of thinking about that now, how they're going to come, you know, how we can protect against them if we can, and that sort of thing.
Well, and one of the things is that each of the branches of government, and I count four because I'm subdividing Congress, the House and Senate, each right. one of them has changed profoundly in terms of the White House is likely to flip from Republican to Democrat. The Senate, the Republicans at best can now be strictly on the defensive, no longer the offensive, no more judges running through there. The House, all of a sudden, razor thin margin for Democrats, a bare majority. And the Supreme Court now 6-3, or as I call it, 5-3-1. Roberts doesn't count on either side, has now obviously cemented a constitutionalist majority for as long as the eye, as far as the eye can see. So
wait, stop right there with that far as the eye can see thing. Justice Thomas could resign tomorrow.
He's not going to resign, Scott. Justice Thomas is not going to resign during a Biden presidency.
Sure, he doesn't but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
He could
die.
He could hit by a bus. Exactly right. Driven by Kamala Harris, for instance.
That's why I say as far. That's why I say as far as the eye can see, or I can't see past a sudden accident or death of one of the justices.
Yeah,
it can't. So as far as we can see, barring of course unforeseen premature death, and Thomas is only 77. I mean, that's 5 years below the average lifespan of the average American man.
For a black man?
I mean, you know, and he doesn't seem to have any health problems we know of. So, I mean, you know, it looks like...
He will, you think he's going to disappoint Julian Malvo, who prayed that he would die an early death upon his
That's
upon
one
his
of
appointment.
The most despicable sound bites ever produced.
All right, well, let's move along. We talked briefly on Liberty Nation Radio, a program that you host that's available on LibertyNation.com, the sponsor of today's Uprising podcast. LibertyNation.com is a conservatarian news and analysis website where we publish articles, audio, and video presentations at LibertyNation.com. So, the Supreme Court... They heard arguments this week on whether jury trials apply to non-unanimous verdicts. Last year, Tim, we talked about it. There was a case that said if you have a life sentence, for instance, you can't have a non-unanimous verdict. Those things were instituted in Louisiana and some other Oregon, where they instituted these things so that basically you could have a black or two on the jury. But still convict people for racist, you know, racist right. purposes, basically. So now it's about whether or not
a mixed jury decides, you know, 5-4 with four blacks on the jury, and the award is still made. Yeah.
Do these people have the right to a new? You know what?
I thought that it was useful, particularly, you know, again, the teachable moment thing. Wait a minute. I mean, how many people do you think know that civil trials generally do not require unanimous verdicts? Because in this country, we're taught based on criminal law, because that's what we see on TV and hear right. the most about in the headlines, that it has to be a unanimous verdict. Whereas, in fact, in civil trials, which involve, as you said, mostly money, maybe property, it can be a preponderance of evidence rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. And an award can be made on even just a majority. And in some states, Scott, do they have like a three-quarter requirement or two-thirds?
So one of the things that you know for sure when you're a lawyer is that in all the 50 states, there are so many different rules and that you don't know them all. And so so it's almost true that no matter what rule you can think of, you can say, well, yes, certainly, Tim, that's true in some states, just because it most likely is. And also, I don't know what they are, just because I haven't studied that as an academic exercise, you know, the panoply of different jury considerations. But yes, non-unanimous verdicts, while not permissible as of last year in serious criminal cases, are permissible in civil cases.
I think of I think of O.J. Simpson in there. There was a criminal trial, and the jury verdict on the criminal charges were unanimous, that he was not guilty. But then there was the civil trial,
yeah,
and everybody knew that would be a slam dunk, and it was, and it was a huge judgment based on the preponderance of evidence in the opinion of the majority right of the jury. So, that, I mean, that's sort of a textbook case of the difference between criminal and civil.
Yeah, that Ron Goldman father, Fred, boy, he took it to the ends of the earth, and good for him.
I would have, too.
Yeah. Well, it takes a lot out of you too. Meaning, you know, that
I can't imagine.
You know, his whole life is now dedicated to that endeavor. All right, let's switch gears entirely, Tim. I want to talk about two stories out there that just there's this Robert Kraft story and the cashless stores.
The cashless thing is kind of interesting.
This week, D.C. City Council says they passed like a package of laws. Among them is cashless stores are banned. New York City City Council passed the same cashless ban basically last week. They're waiting, I think, both on the mayors to sign them, but they said they will. Now, D.C. also banned, seriously, Tim, they banned non-compete clauses in contracts. It's crazy. And some other wacky rules that, like, you know, it's a pandemic and you're trying to attract business. Is this what you want to do? But
is this one of these like catch-all umbrella pieces of
legislation? It was like a hodgepodge more than like a giant thing. But
like put all the different little forms of control into one package.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't think they passed like a $100 minimum wage or anything like that. there was not that craziness. But there was this cashless society or cashless store ban. And you know, we always talk about this one step thinking, and the one step thinking here is there's some poor homeless person who's trying to buy, an Apple, and they're not going to be able to do it because they don't have Apple Pay or whatever the other cashless app the person is requiring, or a credit card. And the problem is these businesses spend a huge amount of money trying to combat theft and fraud and dealing with this cash. And if it's, if they can't make it or maybe they can hire another person to do, you know, real work if they don't have to do this cash management thing, right? I mean, it's like, where's the consideration of their liberty?
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, cash businesses famously, shall we say, are more likely to cheat the margins on what they report than non-cash businesses, shall we say. But the other thing is, the thing that makes me uncomfortable about cashless businesses, where every transaction is online, in a world where privacy, Fourth Amendment is like a relic of the past, I'm not sure that I want every single transaction to have to be in something that can be tracked because
of course, there's a liberty benefit, but the market, Tim, should provide that solution. So when you as a customer decide that you want to pay cash, if you walk out, if they don't have cash or you don't buy as many goods or you choose a different store entirely, that's how you vote with your feet and your dollars. You don't go to city council and say pass. It's like the smoking thing. I remember, you know, those of us are old enough to remember when you could smoke in restaurants like it was cool. There was a movement towards smoke-free dining that wasn't compelled by law. And restaurateurs, some of whom opened up smoke-free restaurants, others had smoke-free sections, others mm-hmm. then kind of segued. Mm-hmm. It went from, you could see the line crossing the room from the smoke-free section to then there was just the smoking section, so which was marginalized, right?
But and of course, it's the same thing in airplanes.
Well, the airplane's a little bit of a, I don't want to confuse it because of the hyper-regulation of air travel versus a restaurant. But people wanted to go to their neighborhood restaurants and not breathe smoke. And what they didn't want to do was the hard work of letting the market take control. So not going, not spending their money there, finding another option or opening their own restaurant, whatever it might be. They just let they applied the lever of government and the violence of government to the problem by saying that, hey, if you want to keep open, without massive fines and confiscatory practices, you're going to do what we say. And that's the same thing with this cashless thing, Tim. You'll find no greater proponent of not having the government be able to track every jot and tittle of people's money than I. But also, let's let the market provide a solution for this rather than hammering these poor business owners who, with another mandate that makes it less likely they're going to be able to stay in business and employ and service citizens of the district.
I mean, I agree completely, and I don't want to imply that I don't like paying. I mean,
yeah, no, I understand.
Let's face it too, that it just does make life. I mean, the streamlining of purchasing these days from online capabilities to how quickly you can pay by just flashing your card at a sensor. Now at most, most places where you pay, you can just flash the card. I mean, all of that really is, I mean, the convenience is important and it moves traffic through. It's more efficient for businesses. But like you said, the key point is that they've been set up for this exact purpose. Their business plan includes being essentially cashless. So when you
here's another aspect of it. By the way, it's funny that you keyed in on the tax aspect of cash businesses, because one of the laws that they passed, the DC, so the cashless thing is both in New York and DC. What I'm about to say is just about DC. They also passed a law where if you are an employee of a business and you call them out for tax fraud, you get some of the juice if the district recovers from them in their tax fraud case. So every aggrieved employee, Tim, is now going to file some sort of tax claim that says, you know, it's just,
well, you just
a recipe
don't
for disaster.
You just don't want to incentivize it. Because yeah. when you reward a particular behavior, you get more of it.
Absolutely.
Pretty simple concept for everything from politics to child rearing.
Yeah, they're going to, it's just an assault on these businesses that I can't abide. The other thing too is a component of the story, I think, is it's the government itself that makes it hard, the access to these electronic forms of payment high. So you can't get an anonymous Visa or MasterCard because of the Know Your Customer regulations designed to prevent money laundering. Even though you could make an exception to a certain low amount, they don't have that, right? So a homeless guy should be able to get for a dollar a Visa card, right, that he can recharge without having a phone number or an address or a driver's license. And then that could make that cashless. In other words, there's a way to do it that doesn't impose on the freedom and liberty of the people who are trying to make a buck in the district, again, by employing people there and servicing the needs of the other folks there. Government could get out of the way instead of getting more in their lives. That's the free market solution to the problem.
Yeah, and the kind that, since I don't know that we'll cover it, but it's a good opportunity to note, talking free market, the death of the giant Walter Williams, who would probably make the same argument you just made.
Walter Williams, for people who don't know, was a economist. He was the John M. Olin fellow, or what's the right way to say it? The George Mason University. And that was a free market dedicated John M. Olin was a man who dedicated his fortune, hundreds of millions of dollars, to moving the ball for greater free market and liberty-based policies in the country. Just a kind of a aside, Tim. You know, the what we have in this country is these foundations that exist often in perpetuity with massive dollars. And well, the massive dollars that act in contravention in the opposite direction of their founding intent. So, Mr. Ford and Mr. Carnegie, for instance,
spinning in their grave,
were not fans of socialism, and you know, they wouldn't have given their money to like indigenous basket weaving awareness, you know, function.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
And if you look at, especially the Carnegie one is the one I've looked most into, and it's so vile. The MacArthur is the one I think is the most vile.
John D. So, and Catherine T.
So no, this is the MacArthur Genius Grants, right? They call them, where they give away like. They give away money. You just have to be a left wing favorite. You could be a musician or a writer or something like that. But when you look at what the intent was absolutely about conservative and free market values. And what happens is the people who get to be the head of these things are rewarded by being more left and more liberal, sort of like the Supreme Court drift, Tim. And so they wind up funding the exact opposite of what the founder would have intended. And in the John M. Olin Foundation, the reason why I bring this up is he made sure that the foundation would close its doors, give away everything and shut down by the time the people who he appointed had died, because he didn't trust anybody that he didn't personally appoint to spend his dough the way that they should.
Well, as you know, I have some experience in this realm, and this is what happens. I mean, original donor intent of successful industrialists and others who started foundations, Rockefeller, everybody. The corruption of donor intent is not dissimilar to how the left corrupts the Constitution by, for example, citing the Commerce Clause as an excuse for any kind of new controls they want to exert on the American people. It's a similar kind of thing. I mean, to twist Henry Ford into someone who at any level would support what the Ford Foundation supports, which single-handedly propping up organizations such as the National Organization for Women, who would not exist absent Ford Foundation support. I mean, a guy like Henry Ford, this is why people on both sides, but particularly conservatives, are very concerned about massive amounts of money poured into charitable organizations with the seeming assurance that it would espouse conservative principles. We've seen too many times where foundations, charitable organizations evolve, so to speak, in their philanthropic priorities. And what you get over a period of time, like with the Ford Foundation, is something that wouldn't even be recognized and would be appalling to its founder.
Yeah, it's a big problem that I think, you know, Trump sort of was going to take a bite out of, but didn't really get to.
That would have been a good second term kind of thing.
But let's play. So the other thing about Walter Williams is that he was a black guy, and that becomes important because he talked and wrote exhaustively and taught exhaustively on the intersection of race and policy, economic policy in these United States. And because he was black, he couldn't be accused of being racist or against black people, which is how so many of the other people who espoused, you know, his views were treated. So he was good for that. And also he could turn a phrase for sure. He was a great presenter of economic principles because I think in a way, perhaps not quite as effective as Milton Friedman, for instance, but he could discuss complex economic terms in a way that was easy for people to access who were not familiar with. You know, sophisticated economic either terms, vocabulary, or concepts. So And he was a stalwart defender of liberty in all instances, I think. And he'll be missed. And I have one clip, I think, that that will do a good job of representing him.
A lot of people say the minimum wage law is an anti-poverty device. It reduces poverty. Well, that doesn't even pass the smell test. I mean, because if it were an anti-poverty device, rather than our spending all these millions and billions of dollars in foreign aid, we just tell Bangladesh and Haiti, you could be rich like we are, just have a higher minimum wage. That's just utter nonsense. And then also, the empirical evidence on the minimum wage law, in 1948, the unemployment rate among black teenagers was 9.4%.
1948.
The unemployment rate among white teenagers was like 10.2. Uh-huh. And the labor force participation rates for black teenagers were greater than white teenagers. Matter of fact, it was 106%. Mm-hmm. And so you say, well, how come in 1948? Was there less discrimination? Is that why? Or were blacks more in 1948 higher skilled than whites? No, it was the minimum wage law.
So again, beyond the one-step thinking. So the one-step thinking is, we'll elevate the the income of blacks by raising the minimum wage. The two-step thing is, what does this do to the market for this labor, right? It destroys.
Scott, you're talking about markets. You're one of these undiluted capitalists. You're not worried about people. You're only worried about markets. But here's the thing. It's very, very simple. I mean, look, do you want higher minimum wage or do you want more jobs? Because you can't have both. You raise the minimum wage, and what does that do? It raises the cost of doing business, which means that businesses in turn have to make decisions. So what are they going to do? They're going to automate. They're going to work with less employees. So you raise the minimum wage, the people that are there, but you cost other people jobs. Very simple, and it's been proven over time.
It's not just the money. It's when you don't have that first job, you don't have those first lessons in how important it is to show up on time, how to treat customers, how to treat the other staff, how to do all these things that are even more important, Tim, for people who can't or don't learn those lessons at home because they're disadvantaged with their home life, or at school where they're disadvantaged with their school life. In other words, yes, for that poor black kid in North Philly, it's even more important that he gets a job when he's 12 years old at the corner store so that he can learn some lessons that aren't being instilled in other ways so that he can be a successful adult, not by your or my definition of it, but by his own.
Well, this all started during the Obama era because we were struggling to get back on our feet after the Great Recession. And he comes into office, and what he created essentially over 8 years, Scott, is what I would call a minimum wage economy. There were so many low-end jobs that constituted employment that a movement grew to compensate the growing number of people in minimum wage jobs. And so that created this demand as if the fact of the economy by itself was either going to lift or lower all the boats, which, I don't know how many times we have to go through this in history where we understand that paying people wages that are not sustainable can crush entire industries. What do you think killed the steel industry in this country? Unions came in. We needed them because workers were working in unsafe conditions and were exploited. True enough. But once they reached a point of strength with the union, it became all about just sustaining the union. And it became unsustainable. And ultimately, we offloaded a lot of our manufacturing overseas. So these are the consequences of unrealistic wages at the low end, because especially since, and the other thing with the minimum wage economy, Scott, is it creates the mindset that a minimum wage job should be something more than
Tim, how can you support a family of four on $7.50 an hour. It's just not
possible. And the point is that it's supposed to be entry level. Minimum wage is entry level. And if you're feeding a family of four off a minimum wage job, then you need to rethink your career. I mean, I hate
family planning choices too, by the way. Nobody talks about that end of the stick, right? Which is why the hell are you having a family all you have is a minimum wage job?
Well, that's a more complex issue because it takes into account a lot of other things. But
it is a complex issue, but also it should be mentioned in the same breath, right? I mean, if the idea is to have people be able to support families, well, one of the things you might do is not have a family until you're financially able to go ahead and do that. You know, Tim, never, ever forget, and don't forget to mention that Barack Obama destroyed so many jobs in this country because what the Obamacare legislation did was it said that you have to offer these benefits to people that work 40 hours or more for your company. So what that did was all these companies dismissed a ton of people, or what they did was they cut their hours massively back. And it was massively
by great coincidence. It happened to be hiring for 1 hour below the cutoff. Well, 1 hour per week below the cutoff.
Well, actually, here's what they wound up doing. What they wound up doing. The smart ones didn't do that because they didn't want to bump up against it, because the penalty is so high for actually coming under that qualification that they cut them way back. So people who had 40 now aren't even getting 30, and then they have to get two jobs and more. Again, this is all to help them, right? So in other words, in order to help the people who work 40 or more get government subsidized low benefit, high premium, high deductible insurance policies in a plan that's backed by the profit-making insurance companies, these people lose part of their income and have to get another job. And I just think, you know, that happened to so many people, Tim. And it's one of those things where, you know, no drama Obama, nobody talks about this consequence of where's the help for these poor people. Let them, you know, just, again, leave them alone. The market was taking care of them. They were doing all right, but couldn't be done. Couldn't leave
them alone. Look, I mean, this is the way that the left does it. I mean, 85% by multiple surveys, roughly 85%, let's call it 80, for argument's sake, be conservative. 80% of Americans were what they described as pleased with their health insurance. Happy with their insurance, didn't want to make a change. Now, 15%, 20% didn't have insurance. So what you would do if you want to make sure they're covered is you say, okay, well, maybe we could, for example, if you insist on having universal coverage, then add a small premium onto everybody's health insurance and just extend Medicaid to everyone. But instead, what they had to do and what the left always does is take the 85% and tear apart what they have in order to fix the 15%. And they wind up, you know, with a system that now has become accepted as the status quo because it's been around so long. Obamacare was reviled at first. Now it's being defended by people like Biden because it's the status quo. And this is how it always happens.
The signature piece of legislation from
signature. Definitely signature. I wouldn't argue with that.
All right. Before we leave, I want to talk about this. These poor women in Florida. Dave Arenberg and William. Let me see what this guy's name is here. Dave Arenberg and Palm Beach County Sheriff William Snyder were the geniuses behind the Robert Kraft arrest and prosecution. Let's recall, Tim, what's at stake. Let's go to the tape.
You can tell a lot about our community by the way it treats its most vulnerable individuals, and that includes victims of human trafficking, which is modern day slavery. Human trafficking is the business of stealing someone's freedom for profit. Including, it can happen anywhere, including in the peaceful community of Jupiter, Florida. In 2017, our office joined with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office and the FBI to help start a human trafficking task force. We are pleased with our progress, but we realize there's a lot more to do. These cases cases aren't about any one defendant or any group of defendants. The larger picture, which we must all confront, is the cold reality that many prostitutes in cases like this are themselves victims, often lured into...
When he says there's a lot more to do, that's when you should be afraid, very afraid.
Well, he's right that you can tell a lot about a society the way they treat these people. And here's how they've treated them, Tim. Robert Kraft, the billionaire, spent a fortune on great counsel and didn't blink. And he got off. The case against him was thrown out. But the victims of the sex trafficking scandal, the woman that he preyed on, who worked at the massage parlor.
Put air quotes around
victims, yeah, there, right? There they are. She was ordered to pay $31,573, Tim, because of the prostitution charge that she was forced to take in order for them to release her property and her phone and some other business. So in order to protect this victim, right, they prosecute Kraft. Tim, it was over a year-long investigation. They planted cameras. It was like they were going after some massive like espionage, like a domestic espionage scandal or something like that, with the level of surveillance and coordination. And they couldn't even find a crime. And the whole thing is based on this headline grabbing thing in these election. There's going to be an upcoming election. They roust about these folks and it buoys them up. At the beginning of that press conference, Mr. Arenberg pauses to make sure that everybody can spell his name. It's his big moment. He's going to ride this into being who knows what in Florida. But fortunately, I think that won't be the case because of what's been revealed, which is how so many of these anti-prostitution stings go. They focus on the women who, if you either A, they're entrepreneurial people who would rather sell sexual services than some other means. That's the strictly economic argument. Or if you go with the victimization argument, even worse, right? That this victim has to spend $31,000 in order to be free of the criminal justice system, and she's a victim. Either way, it's vile and disgusting. And I just hope that this case, because of its profile, kind of lays it bare. This is what usually happens. It's just not usually a billionaire involved who can fight it, right, to the way that he did.
If I could think of one case that encapsulates everything wrong with the current political climate, this case would be it. I mean, here you have grandstanding by, a official of the Florida Department of Justice who is taking advantage of his position for strictly political purposes, targeting somebody, Robert Kraft, because of A, his means, and B, his own political beliefs, C, continuing a case strictly for how it looks, so that he can somehow secure a victory for himself at the expense of the taxpayers who are footing the bill for this.
Millions they've spent on this.
I mean, this is a millions. This is Russia collusion at a smaller level. It's the same thing. There's no crime here. I mean, there is no crime except what? The misdemeanor that, yes, Robert Kraft paid a widower, paid to have sex with someone once. Isn't that all we know? Okay, so he has to pay a fine for that. Good.
Not that we have to get into the details. It wasn't even coitus, by the way. It was a sexual act. And the elderly widow was charged with it, but that all that evidence was thrown out. So we don't even have that.
You know what? This whole thing, how disturbing this is? It's so disturbing that it would almost make me a Patriots fan.
Oh,
not quite. Tim, but it comes dangerously close. And that is quite a statement for me.
Tim, I want to thank you for so many times being a guest on this last, this is your last appearance on The Uprising. I just want to say thank you for joining us on the previous one. And
we welcome Tim Donner for his last appearance.
You'll get your Patriots
final appearance on the uprising.
You'll get your Patriots fan pack.
Oh, wait a minute.
Sometime.
Okay, now hold on just a sec.
Christmas is coming.
Okay, I understand your Patriot hate.
Autographed Tom Brady.
It's common to many people. However,
photo coming.
I've discovered a disturbing pattern, which is an intense Trump-like hatred for the Dallas Cowboys, for starters. Now, okay, we'll give you that as an Eagles fan, and just like the Washington football team that hates the Cowboys.
Good.
You can reserve, and me as a New York Mets fan, I can reserve a singular hatred for the Yankees. That's fine. But when you start extending your hate beyond a divisional rival, Scott, I think you need
and they cheated in a Super Bowl and beat the Eagles. But
the Eagles beat them in a Super Bowl. So what's the complaint?
Well, it should have been two instead of just the one.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah. And that was before they all got woke, by the way. I say a pox on all their houses. As much as that, by the way, shows you how magnanimous I can be, Tim, the owner of such a nefarious enterprise as the New England Patriots, yet I champion his pecuniary interest. So
it is hard to watch it. Do you find that friends of yours that are football fans, Eagles fans, whatever, are turned off by the wokeness?
Not as much as I am. I have gone completely in the opposite direction. You know, maybe it's Tim to the degree that they're political or policy animals in the first place. I mean, if you don't know a ton about policy, you don't have a horse in the political race, maybe you don't care that much about it. But because I know what they're talking about, and I've been involved in policy and politics my entire adult life, and even before that, in meaningful ways, that it's like, oh, you're telling me that we have to do this one thing or else, it's an aggression against what, black people? I've been against the drug war since I even knew what those words meant. But somehow, because I think that maybe one candidate for office is better than another, you're in favor of mass incarceration. Well,
silence is violence, Scott. Silence is violence.
Actually, Tim, I think it was somewhat brilliant marketing. You know, this idea that, that's really what it was. There's a video of after the election of a bunch of Democrat types celebrating at the Black Lives Matter Plaza in downtown D.C. And then a bunch of the Black Lives Matter people are out there saying in very harsh terms that those people need to stop celebrating because the struggle is far from over. They just begun and this, that, and the other. And I just thought, well, those black folks didn't know they were dupes. They're just Democrat Party dupes designed to get Donald Trump out and get Joe Biden in, and then they'll be cast aside.
Well, this is what kind of the AOC wing of the party has been sort of intimating since the election. And you knew it would happen. They'd say, you used us to get, you used us for our votes, and then you're not putting Bernie Sanders in charge of the Treasury, you know? I mean, like that was a realistic. However, I will say that they're throwing some bones, and I want to play this soundbite of Neera Tanden, who was nominated by President-elect Joe Biden to be, and okay, so maybe you, I don't know, put her in Health and Human Services or something like, I don't know. But they nominated her for the Office of Management and Budget. This is a progressive political activist.
We relied on food stamps to eat. We relied on Section 8 housing vouchers to pay the rent. We relied on the social net safety net to get back on our feet. I'm here today thanks to my mother's grit, but also thanks to a country that had faith in us, that invested in her humanity and in our dreams. I'm here today because of social programs.
Now, I'm here because of social programs. That's sort of the perfect outpicturing of this upcoming administration. Is that she talks there about her family and how she had hardship and stuff and how the government came to the rescue. And that's fine. But that is setting the tone for the Biden administration. And it also begs the question of why you would pick someone who so heavily partisan. I mean, as a progressive political activist with no known expertise in budgets to office of
that's
management
why you
and
would.
Budget.
Yeah. She's going to do what you say. LibertyNation.com, today's sponsor of the Uprising podcast. LibertyNation.com is a proud content partner with WhatFinger.com. WhatFinger.com is a news aggregator site, meaning to be the best news aggregator site online. Go ahead and check WhatFinger.com throughout the day for a curated selection of conservative news and analysis. All right, that's all I need from you, Tim. I guess thank you is what I'll say.
But you hear the way you put that. That's all I need from you. You're no good. You know, I'm done with him.
That's like what I'm saying.
One of those attorneys.
What else is there to say?
It's like one of those attorneys who's dressing down a witness, and the witness gives an answer that's not pleasing to the attorney. He goes, I'm done with this witness. I'm done with this witness. Finished.
We're going to get you off the line just so you can go back to your Pat's Forum. and enjoy saying bubbler and other words like that. Ciao. That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, Liberty Nation Radio, the Rabbit Hole podcast, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.